What I'd like to take a look at here is the fast of Tevet. Now, when we talk about the fast of Tevet, we normally associate that with and think about Asar B'Tevet, which is a fast day that is mentioned. The event of the 10th of Tevet is mentioned in several books of the Nevi'im, most notably in the 24th chapter of Sefer Yechezkel, where it uses the odd phrase, Etzem Hayom Hazeh, right down to this exact date. This is the date on which the siege of Yerushalayim began, which is why the Torah suggests that if Asar B'Tevet fell out on Shabbat, we'd fast, because it says Etzem Hayom Hazeh. And the directive or the mention of the practice of fasting on that day is mentioned in the very famous passage in Zechariah Chet, that the fast day of the fourth month, Dainu Tammuz, fifth month, Dainu Av, seventh month, Dainu Tzom Gedalia, and Asiri, the tenth month, which is Tevet, will eventually become happy days. There's also a very interesting historic footnote about the fast of the Asar B'Tevet. There is a the Gemara in Masachet Rosh Hashanah on that odd pasuk. Odd because it says these days of fasting will become days of happiness, posits that when things are great, they will become festive days. And that when things are terrible, they're fast days, and when things are in the middle, it's voluntary. Which would actually seem to indicate that Bizman is that's voluntary, but we'll leave that alone. As a result of that, the Sabbateans had the practice of feasting on the fast days, because the Sabbateans believed that Mashiach had already come, and therefore these days should be fast days. Of course, the most famous historic dispute dealing with the Sabbateans was the Emden Eibeschitz dispute, which erupted in 1751 and lasted forever, really. And in it, Rabbi Yaakov Emden was convinced that Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz was a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, who of course died 80 years earlier or so, and subsequently, basically this war broke out, and one of the claims that Rabbi Yaakov Emden had was that on the tombstone of Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz's wife, who had passed away on the 10th of Tevet, it said that this day, shenepach lanu mi simcha liyagon, this day has been changed from a happy day to a sad day, which is a very odd thing to say about Asar B'Tevet. And so he says, aha, you see, he was a Sabbatean, and therefore he actually held that Asar B'Tevet was a festive day, because Mashiach had already come, and then his wife passed away that day, so that's what changed it. Of course, it didn't say anything like that on the tombstone, and had he gotten up and gone to the cemetery to see it, he would have seen that, but that's part of the whole story that nobody can tell better than Professor Lyman, who was the world expert on Emden Eibeschitz. In any case, I don't want to talk about Asar B'Tevet, because we talk about the fast of Tevet, we think Asar B'Tevet, but the reality is that there are other fast days in the month of Tevet. So, a quick introduction to this. Whenever we study Chanukah, we always make reference to the oldest book of Halakha that we have, which is called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit, which is the first century list, really, of 35 dates in which we are not to fast, and most of them not to eulogize or do any mourning practices, are all because of either political victories of the Hasmoneans or religious victories of the rabbis in different contexts. And Chanukah and Purim are both mentioned in Megillat Ta'anit. However, there is a different Megillat Ta'anit, which is exactly what it sounds like, which is a scroll of fasts, meaning a list of fast days, which first appears somewhere in the 6th or 7th century and made its way into the books of the Poskim. The Rambam does not mention it at all, but it made its way certainly into the books of Chachmei Ashkenaz, starting really with the Halachot Gedolot in Iraq, and then it made it into the Kolbo and into several other works of Halakha, and it made it into Ezra Siman the Shulchan Aruch. There's a whole Siman the Shulchan Aruch saying the following are days in which a person should fast, even though some of them are Rosh Chodesh, you should fast on them. Most of them are days in which individuals died. So Rosh Chodesh Nisan is a fast day because of the death of Nadav and Abihu. I think 26th of Nisan is the day in which Yoshua died. etc. And there's all sorts of different traditions about that. Once we talked about the different traditions about when Yeshua died, because there's a tradition that he died on Yurchet Iyar, and that's where the first time they mentioned Lag BaOmer. In any case, there is this Megillat Ta'anit. In Megillat Ta'anit, there is a mention of a fast day on the 8th of Tevet, a fast day on the 9th of Tevet, and of course, it doesn't have to mention, but we all know about the fast on the 10th of Tevet, which means you have 3 days in a row of fasting. I do not personally know anybody, there may be somebody out there who does, I don't know anybody who fasts on the 8th or 9th of Tevet. We've talked about the 9th of Tevet in the past, because the 9th of Tevet famously, in all of the early sources, says that the 9th of Tevet is a fast day, and the rabbis didn't tell us why, which is very bizarre, and leads to all sorts of speculation as to why it is, and theories upon theories as to why there's a fast day then, and we've talked about that in the past. But the 8th of Tevet, in the Scroll of Fasts, does say why there is such a fast, and I'd like to focus on the connection between the reason given and a much larger, broader phenomenon that we are familiar with in the world of Midrash. And it really cuts into some of the things that we've spoken of many times in this year, which is sort of, which we say, patterns that are established in Tanakh, historic patterns that are established in Tanakh. So the earliest mention that we have all these fasts is in the book Halachot Gedolot. Halachot Gedolot, parenthetically, is one of the earliest attempts to codify the Talmud. And the Talmud, as we all know, is broad, is deep, and is like a maze. And if you are interested in knowing what to do in a particular case and all you've got available is the Talmud, you're lost. You don't know where to look, you don't know how to follow the discussion, and I'm talking about experts. You know, you don't know if there's a dispute, who the final decision follows, etc. And so therefore, even while the Talmud was still being, shall we say, edited and organized and all, there were already attempts in Bavel, typically by some of the Gaonim, to create sort of guidebooks. And one of them, the most famous of the early ones, was called Halachot Gedolot, written, we think, by Rabbi Shimon Kayaira in Iraq in the 9th century. And from then on, it kind of continues developing until finally the first real masterful work of that, which is the Rif's Halachot in the 11th century. Okay. In the Halachot Gedolot, read the following. Source number one on the page. Bishmona betevet nichteva ha-Torah yivanit bimei Talmai ha-Melech. Now, this is a very famous story. The largest presentation of the story is a sugya on Masechet Megillah and has several parallels in the Midrashim. The story of Talmai Philadelphia II, who was the Egyptian, with the Greek ruler from Egypt, from Alexandria, in the 3rd century BCE, who directed the Jewish community to produce a translation of the Torah into Greek. And that translation is something we refer to as the Septuagint. No, we do not have the original Septuagint. The Septuagint that we have is actually a later reworking of it. But in that famous story, as it's told, he assembled 70 or 72 elders, put them in 70 or 72 different rooms, and said to them, "Kitvu li et Torat Moshe Rabchem," write me the Torah of Moshe, your master. And they all translated into Greek, and two miraculous things happened. One miraculous thing happened is they all wrote the same thing, which is quite astounding for a translation.
Why the
70? He wanted them 70. I don't know. I guess he had heard that the Jewish court was 70 or so. And the second thing is that they all made 10 emendations, and the same 10 emendations, and that sugya in Masechet Megillah is something maybe one day we'll look at, because it's a very difficult sugya, because the emendations are made based on sort of an assumption that syntax works the same way in Greek as it does in Hebrew, and it's not true. So, for instance, the first famous emendation is that instead of Bereshit bara Elohim, they wrote Elohim bara Bereshit. Why? Because if Bereshit bar Elohim sounds like Bereshit's the name of a god that created Elohim, which would fit Greek mythology very well. But the problem is that, of course, in Greek, you're not going to write it that way. So our Septuagint reads En Archein, in the beginning, right, that Theos created, God created, and there's no confusion there. It's a little hard to understand what the problem was, but in any case, according to that tradition, all 70 of them were inspired to make the same 10 emendations so that there would be either a lack of theological unclarity or to obscure some things that are maybe a little bit unquiet, disquieting, etc. In any case, how do we look at that translation? Important to note, in the Sugya on Megillah, that translation is looked at favorably. And indeed, the reason that that story is brought in Megillah is because the Mishnah in Megillah, the famous series of Mishnayot known as the Ein Bains, in which we compare two things that are similar and identify the few differences between them, is that Ein Bains Sfarim leTefillin Mezuzot, the only difference between a Sefer Torah, get ready for a surprise, and Tefillin Mezuzot, is that a Sefer Torah can be written in any language, Tefillin Mezuzot can only be written in Hebrew, and then the Rav Moshe Gamliel says, no, Sfarim can only be written in Greek. Hebrew and Greek. And then the Gemara says, why is it what can be written in Greek? Because of this whole story of Talmai HaMelech. And then it concludes with the famous drasha of Noach's blessing to Yefet, and our understanding, our anthropological slash genealogical understanding, that the Greeks are descendants of Yefet, that Yaft Elohim LiYefet, which literally means God should broaden the boundaries of Yefet, as reading it, that the beauty of Yefet, Vishkon Boale Shem, should reside in the tents of Shem, and thus the beauty of Greek civilization should really reside in the holy places of the Jews, which of course is very strange coming off of Chanukah as we are, and sort of an opposite perspective. But in any case, in the Sugya there, it's clear that that this whole story is a kind of a positive development. Here there's a different take on it, which is that on the 8th of Tevet, the Torah is translated. It might maybe perhaps even assumes that this is a one-day job, which itself is kind of startling. All right, Bimet HaMelech Uva Choshech LaOlam Shlosha Yamim, and the world was filled with darkness for 3 days. The 3 days here may, of course, be the 8th, 9th, and 10th of Tevet, which then all 3 days end up being fast days, and so, as such, the 8th of Tevet is a fast day. Okay, what I want to look at is not so much the issue of the translation and why translating is such a bad thing. I think it should be fairly obvious to us what the pros and cons of any translation are. The obvious pros, but the cons of translation, in a sense, are the pros. One of the pros of translation is accessibility. And accessibility may indeed be one of the cons. Because when you make the Torah accessible to other people, there's all sorts of opportunities for them to manipulate it and to agendize it, etc., which is not the case when it is an esoteric text that's kept within the people. But there's also obviously the danger that in time you translate, you're losing 80% of the available information, which is sort of encoded, and I don't mean that in any mysterious way, which is encoded in the language. You have so many double, triple entendres and word plays and everything else that happen in Hebrew, which just don't work in translation, as it is with any text. When you translate Shakespeare into Yiddish, you lose a lot of the beauty. You know, I'm not saying Hebrew is supposed to anything else. Just any work that's translated from the original is going to lose a lot of that. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, but there's still so many different interpretations of biblical text as it is.
Correct, and all those are lost in translation. That's exactly the point. The reason that a translation is harmful is because, this is why I do not allow my students to bring in an English Tanakh, ever. They have to come in with the Hebrew-only Tanakh, is because the translation blinds you. You read the translation, you immediately think, this is what it means, and you're not open to seeing that that word may mean 15 different things, and all of them may be legitimate interpretations. The reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe that word to write, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other, it may be to give multiple meanings, maybe this meaning or that meaning, we don't know. But the minute that we assign a particular meaning, what we typically do is we shut down all the other possible meanings. So just as an example, I'm teaching one of my classes right now the story of Yosef. And in English that would be, I'm teaching the story of Yosef right now in one of my classes. Sorry for the syntactical error. And today I gave the boys an assignment to identify five distinctions between the first dream and the second dream that Yosef had. And one of the boys went up to the board and wrote, in one of the dreams his mother appears. I said, who said his mother appears? He said, well, the moon. I said, who said the moon means his mother? He said, it says it right there. I said, really? Who said it? He said, I don't know, God said it. I said, well, take a look again. He said, oh, Yaakov said it. So that's Yaakov's interpretation. Maybe there's other interpretations. The problem is we're so used to reading Yaakov's interpretation as being the text that we can't even open up to the possibility that the moon might mean something else, like the moon, in Yehoshua Perkyot. Right? So you're right that there are many commentaries, but the commentaries are all working off the original. Any commentary, nobody writes a commentary written on based on a translation, because that's sort of silly. But the problem with translation is the translation cuts off the avenues of creative commentary because the original is not there. And even if you know the original, when you read the translation, you often develop blinders to other possibilities. Right? Every translation is a selection. It's a choice of one interpretation over many. Right? So anyways, that's what some of the cons are.
We learned the list of reasons, it was Tisha B'Av, 3 weeks. Wasn't this translation one of those on that this happened on that day also?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that this is mentioned in any other context. So anyhow, in our text here, we find that there's a mention that the darkness came to the world for 3 days. Right? So the question is, do we read this literally or not? And by the way, this is a general methodological issue. When you hear a story like this, do you read it literally, meaning the whole world went dark for 3 days? Or do you read it as either metaphorically or associatively or something like that, that it's supposed to create some sort of a connection with some other event of darkness? Good question. By the way, this is, as I said, a general methodological approach to Agadah. So when you read the Agadah, technically the most famous Agadah that we have, Rebbe Eliezer of Yeshua and the stream and the tree, etc. Did the tree really fly? Did the stream really go backwards? Did the walls really incline? Bottom line, it may not matter. The question is, how do you read it? And in a sense, reading it literally makes your job a lot easier. It happened, it happened. But if I read it metaphorically, then suddenly I've got to find meaning behind a stream and Dafka, carob tree, and Dafka, 100 cubits. All the items in the story now have to be deliberate because it's metaphoric.
There certainly could be 3 days of darkness, a volcano explodes or something.
Yeah, but then it's, the whole thing is defeated. If it's some sort of natural occurrence that happened to happen when they translated it, then it loses any meaning as being associated with this, and there's no reason to fast. The notion here is that there was clearly some divine disapproval for this act, that it was so terrible, it brought 3 days of darkness, and therefore we fast, because we see God doesn't like it. Right? So we have to see what that's about. So what I'd like to do is, instead of getting directly to an answer, I'd like to take a look at several other midrashim that we have that perhaps follow a similar pattern. Right? And one of them, we just finished Chanukah, is the most famous story about Chanukah, which of course, as we all know, is a story that only shows up in one version of the Schol Yonah Megillat Tanit. It shows up in the Gemara, but it is hands down the most famous story about Chanukah. You ask the average guy on the street, non-Jew on the street, what were the Jews celebrating? And they will tell you nothing about a war. They'll tell nothing about a Beit HaMikdash, nothing about a Mizbeach. All right? Certainly nothing about Antiochus and a Gzeirah against Brit Milah, etc. But they will tell you that they lit some oil and it lasted 8 days. Now, that is in source number 2. And, of course, most famously shows up Masachat Shabbat, but its origins, as I said, are in the Schol Yonah, the commentary on Megillat Ta'anit. A third example of this, and again, we're not necessarily putting them all together, but we will, is a beautiful Agadah that we studied here, I think, many years ago, which is the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and the cave. All right, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai ended up in a cave for 12 years, and then for another year after that, and came out. And interestingly enough, that story is told in two different places in the Yerushalmi, mainly for the purposes of explaining the impact on the city of Tveria, which he later purified as a result. But in the Bavli, it's told with a whole bit of background, which is the story that you see here with Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon sitting together. And this whole story is told in order to explain why Rabbi Yehuda have the position, given to him by the Romans, by the way, of Rosh HaMedavrim B'chol Makom, prime speaker. Why was he called prime speaker? Because of this story. Because Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon were sitting around. Rabbi Yehuda said, the Romans make such beautiful things. They make such beautiful roads and marketplaces and bathhouses. Rabbi Yossi said nothing. And Rabbi Shimon got up, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai got up and protested and said, what are you talking about? They make the marketplaces in order to put zonot there and to seduce our young men. They put the bridges there in order to take tolls from us. And they set up the bathhouses in order to just hedonistically glorify themselves and pamper themselves. And the Romans heard about it. The Romans then said, okay, Yehuda, who praised us, will be elevated. It works better in Hebrew. Yehuda she'ila yit'aleh. Yossi, who was silent, will go into exile in his town of Sipori. and Rishon Mordechai, who degraded us, will be killed. And the contract went on his head. He went into hiding with his son, first in the Beit Knesset, then into the cave, etc. Now, the rest of the story is all interesting, but not for our particular purpose. Because this Midrash, which is really an Agadah, it's not a Midrash, meaning it's an Agadah about these Chachamim, is a story that's being told in real time. Meaning that it's in the Midrashic literature about Chachamim whose names themselves are in the Midrash. That does not mean that the story was put together or composed at the time, but we sort of feel it as a period piece. There's another Midrash which sounds very similar, which actually is not a period piece because it's told in the Midrashic literature about characters in Tanakh. And by the way, about four characters who at no point in history do we ever see any of them meeting each other. And they are Paro, Yitro, Bilam, and Eov, who may not have existed according to Chazal. Right? And there are this very famous Midrash in Shemot Rabbah about Paro's decision to kill throw the little babies in. It says that Paro took counsel with three wise men, Bilam, Yitro, and Eov. Bilam said, kill him. Eov was silent, and Yitro ran away. So what was God's reaction? Yitro, who ran away, will have descendants who will be on the Sanhedrin. Eov, who was silent, will suffer in silence, and Bilam, who gave the bad advice, will be killed on the battlefield. Now, if you listen to it, you hear an inversion of our story about Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, and Shimon, in which God is now playing the role of the Romans. Right? What did the Romans do? They said, Yehuda praised us, he's praised. Yosef was silent, he goes into exile. And Rabbi Shimon, who degraded us, will be killed. Here, Paro took advice. So the man who gave the advice to kill children will be killed. The man who is silent, also exile, suffering. And the man who refused to comply and ran away, he's the one who was raised up. But it's a flip on the same story. Okay. Going back to the cave story, there's another component of the cave story which fits this model, and you may or may not be surprised that when we turn the page over, we're going to suddenly see not Midrashim, but Tanakh. And that is...
I'm a little confused. Yeah? You're talking about this as a literary allegory, or...?
I'm just pointing out different phenomena that are in the Midrashim, and we're going to tie all these bows together in a few minutes. Right now, there's just a bunch of slip knots that are out there. We have to tie them together. In the story back of Shimon bar Yochai and his son, they first ran away to a Beit Knesset, they hid there, and then they realized that it's not safe, they ran away to a cave. What happened in the cave? A miracle happened. A spring of water appeared at the mouth of the cave, and a carob tree grew, and they were able to subsist for all those years on the carob and on the water. At the end of the 12 years, a bat kol came out and said that... Eliyahu Hanavi came and announced that the Caesar has died, meaning the Roman governor has died, and the amnesty has been declared, and you can leave. Eliyahu. Okay. Other things, by the way, happened in Agadah at that cave from Shubha and Levi with Mashiach. Interesting piece. All right, where is all this going? So I want to take you to one more story, and then we're going to start looking at some Tanakh. Who is Onkelos? So Onkelos is a convert who is a family with Roman nobility, and he's converting. And according to this, his uncle was Titus, and he sent the soldiers to go bring Onkelos to him to be killed because he had converted to the hated Jewish people, right? So as the first group of soldiers came and they said, "We got to take you there," Onkelos started talking to them. By the time he was finished talking to them, they had all converted. So the king sent another group. He sent the second group, they came there, and he told them, don't talk to him. So he somehow got them engaged in conversation. And he sent the third group finally. And the third group, he said, don't say a word to him, don't let him say a word, nothing. So they took him out. As they're taking him out, they won't talk to him. He puts his hand on the mezuzah. And so they, of course, say, what's that? He says, a king needs people to guard him on the outside. We have God guarding us from the outside. We're on the inside, God guards us from the outside. Immediately they all converted, and the king gave up. All his soldiers and all his men couldn't put, back together again. All right, so where is all this going? So I want to show you something phenomenal relating to this last story. This is an Agadah told about Onkelos. Important to note, it's an Agadah told significantly after the event, which means maybe it happened that way, maybe it happened a different way, maybe it's a way of telling a story of how powerful Unklus was as a preacher, whatever it may be. Shmuel, Sefer Shmuel, you've heard of it. In Sefer Shmuel, a good part of Shmuel Aleph is Shaul chasing David. The chase begins with that famous Ferris Bueller scene, remember it? Where David sneaks out the window and Michal sets up his bed as if he's in it, like that scene in Ferris Bueller with the inflatable thing in it, and David gets out and he goes all the way up to Ramah, where Shmuel, who got him in trouble in the first place by anointing him, is leading an exercise of Nevi'im, a B'nai Nevi'im, and Shaul then realizes what happened and Shaul wants to kill David. This is when it gets open. And Shaul sends a group of soldiers to David. In the meantime, where is David? David is with Shmuel, who is leading a prophetic exercise, a rapture exercise, if you will, a prophetic rave. And the first group of soldiers comes. This is in Tanakh now. What happens when the first group of soldiers comes? Let's take a look. So what happens to the first group of Shaul's soldiers? They're seized by prophecy, they become Nevi'im. Prophet's not going to kill David. Right? They tell Shaul that your soldiers defected, basically. Right? He sends another group. He sends three groups of Nevi'im. What happens to all of them? They all become Nevi'im, and they certainly do not bring David's head back. So what happens? Shaul finally goes, says, you want a job done, right? Do it yourself. He goes, and what happens to him? He becomes a Navi, and while he's a Navi, Agam Shaul Nevi'im, David runs away. Now, this is a story in Tanakh. The fundamental story that is the start off of the Shaul chasing David cycle. It starts here. What happens in this story? If you will, the big bad king chases after the loyal, humble servant who stands for goodness, and he sends a group of soldiers, and the soldiers are directed by God other ways. He sends a second group, he sends a third group, and finally gives up. That's the story of Unklus. Wait a second, that's the story of David. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is that when Chazal wanted to describe how a member of the royal Roman family could successfully convert and become something of a teacher among the Jewish people, in spite of the fact that he's related to the Roman nobility, the story they tell is the story of David and Shaul, which, by the way, is really a bad, nasty comment about Shaul, if you think about it. Because if David is Unklus, then who's Shaul? Right? Okay. Let's roll back. What kind of person is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai depicted as in these stories? Is he calm or zealous? He's zealous. He's a real zealot. Who was the most famous zealot in all of Tanakh? Eliyahu Navi. He says, Kanokineti, I'm zealous for you, God. Well, the first thing Eliyahu Navi does is he comes out and he says, no rain. 3 years, no rain. God then directs him to go where? To Nachal Crit. He goes to Nachal Crit. And what does God do? God arranges for ravens to bring him meat every day, and there's a spring of water there for him to drink from. That sound familiar? So now, the way that Chazal tell the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is very much patterned after the story of Eliyahu Navi. Is it any surprise that it's Eliyahu Navi in the story who comes to tell Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai you could leave the cave? Whose cave is it? It's kind of their joint cave. Interesting, we're going to get to next week's parasha. Next week's parasha is Parashat Vayechi, where Yaakov blesses his children on his deathbed. What happens on his deathbed? Who is the one who's made the king on his deathbed? Yehuda. Okay? Who is the one who essentially is taken apart and almost disinherited? Shimon. Because Levi, even though it's Shimon and Levi together, Levi later is resuscitated through the kohuna. Shimon's not. So Yehuda is elevated to the position of king. Shimon is pretty much disenfranchised. And who is it who is the macher, but only in exile? Yosef. Go back to the story of the Romans. What do the Romans say? Yehuda yit'aleh. Yehuda is raised. Shimon is is killed, and Yosef goes to exile. Yosef. So exactly the way they have it, it's almost like the Romans are reading Parshat Vayechi and summing it up in this story about the division of the Chachamim. I'll take you back to two other stories in Tanakh, and then bring this together before we get to the end. Elisha is Eliyahu's prime student. Elisha fulfills miracles, catalyzes miracles, very much in the spirit of what Eliyahu does. And one of the most famous ones, and it's famous partially because of the Haftarah, Parshat Vayera, is when the Isha Shunamit has a kid. But before that, there's a small story written part of the Haftarah, where there is a poor widow, it's always a poor widow, who comes to Elisha begging for help. Why? Because she has a big debt, and she has a son, and she can't pay the debt, she has nothing left in the house, and the noshe, the creditor, is going to come and seize her child as a slave. What does Elisha tell her to do? Go take all, borrow all of the empty vessels that you can, and start pouring oil. And as long as there are empty vessels, they will fill up with oil. And miraculously, her oil thing just doesn't stop. She pours oil and it doesn't empty out. It keeps emptying into the thing, but it's still got oil in it. Until finally she's filled up all of her kelim, then she's out of oil, then she's got enough oil, she sells it, she pays off the debt, and Shalom on Yisrael. That sounds familiar? Oil that just keeps on going? Wow. Interesting. And then when we read in Divrei HaYamim that Chizkiyahu re-purified the Beit HaMikdash, he dedicated it with an 8-day celebration of dedication. Whoa! So here we are 300 years after the story of Hanukkah, and we're retelling the story of Hanukkah, and how do we tell it? We basically tell it using Tanakh stories. Wait, how do we tell the story of Shem Bar Yochai? We use Tanakh stories. How do we tell the story of Unkos? We use Tanakh stories. Okay, so now let's go back to our translation of the Torah into Greek. By the way, in what country did that happen? Ptolemy was the Greek emperor in Egypt. So I want you to picture it. Here are the Jews in Egypt translating the Torah into Greek. God is not happy with it, obviously, from the way this story is told. And what happens? A great darkness comes on the land for 3 days. Does that sound familiar to you? Darkness for 3 days? Look at the last source. So now, what is the phenomenon that we're encountering? And it's a phenomenon that doesn't just flip, it flips and flips backwards. It is that when we want to tell a story, and this is a critical distinction that we have to make. When we want to tell a story, are we concerned with getting the historic facts accurate? I will tell you that that is a modern concern. It's a modern concern. What we are really trying to do is to illustrate a point. Now, it's not a modern concern when it's a question of whose property is this. That's a perennial concern. But whether the walls fell like this or like that, whether it was three sets of soldiers or two sets of soldiers, or if you want to take a page out of this week's Parsha, whether it was 66 people or 70 people, we're not as concerned with getting the historic record accurate nearly as much as what the message is of that story. And that's why throughout the Torah, numbers are used in typological fashion with rounding. Do we talk about 70 people going down? Because 70 is an important message about going down. Maybe 66 go down. There's another 40 in Egypt. All right. But in Dvari, Moshe doesn't say 66 went down, he says 70 went down. Because we're concerned with what the message is of that story. Here, what we've got is, this is just a sampling of examples where in Midrashei Chazal, Chazal utilize, the pattern that's presented in a particular story in Tanakh in order to then imprint it on later history. And I believe that it reflects an essential hashkaf of Chazal, which is elucidated by none other than the Ramban. And that is that history is made up of patterns. And that the foundational book of those patterns is the book of Bereshit. And that perhaps, as I've argued in the past, the foundational chapters of Bereshit are the first 11 chapters. Everything up until Abraham is sort of setting the stage for history. The battle between older and younger son, the battle between farmer and shepherd, the issue of exile as a motif. Everything is, already starts in the first 11 prakim. It then gets expanded and personalized in the rest of Sefer Bereshit, and from then on, almost every major story finds its anchor in Sefer Bereshit. You want Megillat Rut? Look at Tamar and Yehuda. You want Amnon and Tamar? Look at Yosef, the Kanat Pasim. Look at Daniel and Mordechai? There's Yosef. Almost every major story you've got in Tanakh finds its anchor in Sefer Bereshit. And what Chazal here is simply doing is taking that notion and building it out further. So that the stories they tell are absolutely true. The way that they tell the story is in a familiar pattern in which what they're really doing is saying, if you want to understand what's happening in the story, you got to learn its story in Tanakh. And we're creating that association by using a similar frame as the one in Tanakh to create that connection.